coming to you from the depths of Hell's Kitchen. You are tuned in to the Cave of Solitude. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and I am joined by the incomparable, the legendary, the princess of podcasts. State your name, co-host.
It's Lady J.
Lady J.
I thought you were going to say I'm from the depths of hell. I'm like, where is it going with this?
Well, if you can't tell, obviously we changed up the intro just a little bit because this is a special book club episode where we will no longer be in the mega city metropolis of Toronto. We are focusing our minds, getting into the spirit of Matt Murdock himself, and we're finding ourselves in New York City's Hell's Kitchen as we discuss the classic Frank Miller, John Romita Jr. graphic novel, The Man Without Fear, Daredevil. Daff J, before we go any further, what's the weather like?
Well,
is it still snowing?
You know what? It was. It was flaking a little bit.
Hell was freezing over.
I'm so tired of this long winter. It needs to stop.
But the sun has been out. The weather's getting warmer. And yes, there is gin in your drink.
Why does yours look gold?
Because it's ginger ale.
Just ginger ale?
I need a little bit of...
Why did I get a special...
You did get a special drink. You didn't want ginger ale. Moving on. The weather is getting better. Kobe is in the house.
Why do you have her in a headlock?
She just put herself there. She wants to say something in the mic. Before this gets out of hand, what is new and exciting, Daff J, since we last spoke? I know what's new and exciting in your life, but tell your listeners.
I'm reading a book.
I love it.
I'm on a roll.
You're on a roll.
And you know what?
And you're finishing your books.
Yeah, like I'm actually moving along.
Are you enjoying the things that you're reading, or are they chores? That's the key.
No, I am enjoying it. I'm having fun.
Do you want to talk a little bit about what you're reading currently? Before we dig into The Man Without Fear?
Yes, so I'm reading a Batman comic.
No, you don't say.
And, I like it. It's kind of not what I expected. And I'm experiencing a lot of different, I'm feeling a lot of conflicting emotions reading this particular series of comics. So what I'm reading right now is Death and the Maidens, written by Greg Rucka.
Who's the artist?
Klaus?
Yes.
Jansen.
You had more of a pause saying the last name than the person. Klaus Jansen, yes. Klaus Jansen, you're familiar with his work, you may not know the name, but he was, he's a well-known inker that did a lot of Frank Miller's art. So Dark Knight Returns, Klaus Jansen was the inker. I don't know if you can kind of tell that there's somewhat of a similar kind of style between him, Frank Miller, John Romita. There's the way they shape the face.
Which one? Dark Knight Returns?
Dark Knight Returns and had Klaus Jansen was the inker on that book.
Okay.
And he usually or frequently is inking John Romita Jr. nowadays. But I don't know if you can, when you read it, if you can kind of get a little bit of a similarity between him
very and subtle.
John Romita a little bit, right?
Now that you say that, it's very subtle, but I do particularly like the art in this
comic book.
A lot of the characters look very real.
Yeah, okay.
And anyway, so this story, I just started today. I'm literally halfway through it. And there's a lot of, I guess, to kind of whet the appetite a little bit. It kind of revolves around one of his greatest enemies, Ra's al Ghul. And in this story, Ra's al Ghul is facing his own mortality, which we know, or fans would know, he's always kind of winning the game by seeking the Lazarus Pit and
cheating death.
Pretty much. And extending his life. So, at this point, though, he's kind of running out of options. And he seeks the help and assistance of the detective. But obviously Batman doesn't just like, hey, yeah, sure, I'm gonna help you out. But he basically tries to lure Batman, or make kind of give him something, give him incentive to help him out. And what he offers Batman is the opportunity to see his parents again. And at first I was a little skeptical. I'm like, I don't know if I want to dabble in this kind of, you know, I don't want to dig in the grave for anything. But basically it's a potion that I guess that he gave him, that gives him the illusion, or kind of, it's like a mind trick type of thing, that gives him the opportunity to have, I don't know,
a what if conversation.
Yeah. And it's not what you think it would be. Seeing these, we only ever know Martha Wayne and Thomas Wayne as, you know, a doctor and just lovely people that had that were loved by the public, and victims. To see them in a different light, and experience a one-on-one conversation with Bruce as an adult. That's never happened before. At least I've never encountered something like that. So it was a very different take on what is happening between these two, these three individuals.
So you're invested.
Yeah.
It's intense.
Yeah.
You got this look on your face like you're just... It's exhausted you.
It is very heavy, and I'm totally lost in it. Like, I'm on the train or I'm on the bus and people are talking to me. I'm like, wait, I'm at a good part right here. Just hold on a minute. So yeah, I'm not done yet.
No, but you're plowing through it.
I'm totally into it. It's really, it's very different.
Are you paying more attention to who the creative teams are nowadays on the books that you're reading, or is it still inconsequential to you? It's just like, I want to read a Batman story and I'm going to like it because it's Batman, or I want to read a Daredevil story, and just as long as, you know, I tell you, hey, this is a good one, or what's your stance on it? Are you becoming more aware of creators? No.
No, I'm not. I want to be, but the thing, you know what it is? I find that when I pick up a certain, book or comic book or whatever, I find myself being following a certain type of writer without even knowing it.
Right.
Liking a certain writing style.
Yeah.
Or artist without even knowing it. And I think one of the last things that I read of Greg Rucka was the Gotham Central comics that I read a while back. And it was not at all what I thought I would... I love that series. I thought it was great. It was great writing. It was a great story. It invited you into the personal lives of people. And it brought it to life. Mm-hmm. And I really, really liked it. Yeah. And again, not particularly knowing anything about this story, I completely forgot that Greg Rucka... That's not something I look for. But being more familiar now, going forward... now I think I'll be a little bit more in tune of what I pick up because of who's behind it. So I'll try to keep it in mind.
Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there was a time where I was so character, like I follow characters more than the writing team or the art team, that I was kind of like what you described. Like I was told this is a good story, so I'll read it. Until I started to kind of pay attention a little bit more to the credits. And you start to realize that it's not even so much, yeah, you like Batman, you like Superman, whoever it might be, Spider-Man. But once you start realizing, like, that was a great story, it opens you up, and you see this guy wrote it or this guy drew it, it opens you up to trying a different character.
Right.
And Greg Rucka, from what I've seen thus far, I've been kind of reading a bunch of his stuff and creator-owned books as well. And they've all been good.
Mm-hmm.
So it leads me to realize it's not just the character that I like, but it's also the person that's writing the character that does a good job.
Yeah, and I think with Greg Rucka, again, I've only read a handful of things. But like I said, in Gotham Central, he tapped into the personal lives of certain characters, and he made you personally, I guess, invested in them. And in this story, you are getting to know Raish and his background, and that he has offspring. There's daughters in his story, and each one of them has their own story to tell and own experiences. And, you know, Bruce and Alfred kind of have a little bit of... I mean, they've always had a connection, but they're butting heads a little, and where their distrust in certain things, how they express it to each other, it's very meaningful. Actually,
cool.
And I'm so far, like I said, I'm literally in the middle of it, but I'm having a good time. It's fun.
Yeah. He's well known for writing strong female characters. He has a current book out right now called Lazarus, and the main character is a female. He was did a really well known run for Wonder Woman, Batwoman. Batwoman is basically, he fleshed out that character, the one from the Bad Blood movie. He wrote her in Detective Comics and created her entire history, and the whole Renee Montoya story arc from Gotham Central. Those were like his favorite things to work on, so he's got a knack for writing really good strong female characters. And I enjoy almost everything I've read from him. Even some of his Superman stuff is really strong, so it's cool to see that he's going to be back. We mentioned last episode he's going to be on the Wonder Woman book, so I'm happy you like it. I heard him talk about it on another interview, and I thought, this sounds like a book Daphne would like. I kept seeing it at this 50% off bookstore, half off bookstore, and I was like, should I get it? I don't know about it. Is it one of his earlier works that might not be too good? But then when I heard the interviewer specifically ask him about it, I was like, I gotta find it before it disappears, because I don't think it's in print right now. So glad that you're enjoying it.
Good find.
Are you ever going to ask me what I'm reading?
Oh, yeah.
I'm just kidding. If I get into it, it will be here forever just talking about... In the last 2 days, I think I've read 5 graphic novels.
Yeah, you're a beast.
Something ridiculous.
Oh, my gosh.
So, I've been reading a lot of stuff. One of the things I haven't recommended on the show that I'd like to, and it is a... It's not a very imaginative pick when you think of what Eric likes, but Injustice, the video game Injustice from DC Comics, they made a comic book series.
That's such a good game. I beat you all the time.
You do not, but we won't get into that. But the comic is actually better than the game.
Okay, but I do though.
You sometimes.
When I play Green Arrow.
But when I'm Joker and you're Batman, what happens? You drop the controller because you're scared of seeing Batman get set on fire. But that's a conversation for another time. But if anyone wants to pick up a comic book that's not in too deep with like comic book continuity, pick up Injustice Volume 1, the complete first year. It is a page-turner. You won't stop reading. You will constantly be picking up that book and wanted to see what happens next. And it is a kind of like an Elseworlds story, so it's not your typical Superman, Batman, Justice League.
So you don't have to know anything to pick this up.
You just have to know your general knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. Superman and Lois Lane are a happy married couple. Batman has his family and his Robins and his Nightwing, and there's the Justice League. And
then there's bad guys.
And then, yeah. You just gotta have your general knowledge of the DCU. If you've played the game, you kind of know what it's about. But This fills in the gaps of everything that happens within the game. All the things that you don't know.
Okay.
What leads Superman to become a...
There's more detail.
There's more detail. Mm-hmm. Yes. So, highly recommend it. It's a page-turner.
I've seen that thing. It looks like an omnibus.
It's not an omnibus.
It's pretty thick. And I just want to play the game. But it does sound like a really good story.
We should cover it one day. Because it seems to me when I watched...
While we play the video game and I beat you, that's how we should...
Yeah, because you'll be beating me because I will be reading it. And that's how you'll finally get a chance to beat me. But when I watched, and I don't want to bring it up again, but when I watched BVS, it kind of reminded me of more of that book than it did of the regular Batman and Superman. So if that's what they're going for, they should have just called it Injustice, A Dawn of Injustice. That's what it felt like. Anyways, we're going to spin a web and swing over to the Marvel Universe and visit some of the great characters in that domain. So let's cross the street, head over to the other building that used to be in Manhattan, and visit the Marvel offices and talk about Daredevil. So Daff J, are you familiar with Frank Miller and some of his well-known, well-established comic book works?
Yes.
Do you like the things that you have read from him?
Some, a bit. I find that with Frank Miller, I'm kind of on the fence a little bit.
What are you on the fence about?
I find him to be a little extreme sometimes. He's very biased, I find. You know, if he doesn't like a character, he's going to portray them as someone that you're not going to like. If he's pro a character, they cannot be any more worshipped than they are in the book. So,
that's a very good observation.
Thank you. So I find his storytelling to be either very excessive, or just very like, and very in your face. And sometimes it's just a little too extreme for me, but it holds weight. The message and the storytelling that's behind it, it is a good story.
Okay.
So like I said, I'm kind of on the fence with him.
And you know what? A lot of people have, in more recent years, have commented very similarly to what you've just mentioned now. He's become a little bit more of a polarizing figure. I don't know if you remember when we were at the Toronto Comic Con, and we were in that comic book workshop,
mm-hmm.
and the guy who was leading the panel, that artist slash writer, he kept making references to Frank Miller,
right,
and being right. very facetious and bold about how much he disliked
mm-hmm.
Frank
mm-hmm.
Miller.
Yeah.
But then you had other people who are in the comic book industry and
because
are artists
him.
Because of him.
Yeah.
So, not to fly back over to the DC universe, but Dark Knight Returns, where do you place that in your pantheon of Batman books?
I think it's an excellent story. I think it's what made the Batman that we know today.
Mm-hmm.
That's what started it all. But certain relationships, certain portrayals of, like I said, of certain characters, I feel like it kind of squandered certain relationships as if they weren't meaningful. It kind of tainted a little bit of a history that was there before.
Okay.
And like I said, it kind of messes with your head a little bit.
Yeah, that particular work is, people forget it's a possible ending. It's like a what if this is the last Batman story.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people have taken it as, for lack of a better term, canon. Like, this is the definitive Batman story. Like, some people look at it like the Batman Bible, and it's not. But it had such a strong impact
yeah.
that it influenced generations of Batman readers and creators. They're
mm-hmm.
trying to channel that Batman. How about Year One?
I think Year One is a great story. I love Year One. I think I like Year One better than I like Dark Knight, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah.
And why is that?
I like the character development. I felt there was a build-up. Not just of Bruce and him becoming Batman, but of Commissioner Gordon or Lieutenant Gordon or before Officer Gordon. Like,
right,
there was something there. And I think it's in that story where Gordon, we see his wife and she's pregnant.
Mm.
So you see a family man, too. Not just this guy in a raincoat.
Yeah.
And how they kind of flourish into the people that we know them to be today.
Yeah.
And you kind of see, like, what's that phrase? Like, they kind of earned their stripes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So when you read their story, you're like, yeah, no wonder he's like that. No wonder he's fearful, and no wonder he's bitter, and no wonder he's sad. You know, Commissioner Gordon being sad, but he won't leave the city because he has a hope. And It kind of it's one of those stories that brings all the other stories that you've already come to know and understand. It brings them all together a little bit.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I think this year one is one of those fundamental things. It kind of acts as a baseline to how everything else came into fruition. Dark Knight, on the other hand, like I said, I find it very... It just seems like a battle the whole way through. It's just chaos.
It's a lot of commentary, too. It's a lot of social commentary of what people's views on... What people's views were in the mid-80s. It was almost like a... not a response, but it was a contemporary work of Watchmen, where both of them were very critical of the politics that were going on around them. There was a lot of references to the Cold War between the U.S. and Russia, and both books had somewhat of those elements. How would superheroes fit into mm-hmm. that world?
Right.
And, you know, Watchmen was a criticism on how crazy people must be to be superheroes in a world like this. What would lead someone? They wouldn't be nice people. They'd all be bad people. Mm-hmm. And they'd be a detriment. And then in Frank Miller's book, it was, you know, the criticism on Superman and how he was just a stupid government, I don't know what the word, Boy Scout.
Yeah.
And so they were very similar and compared, and they're held in the same regard for good reason. They're both really good books. But I bring up, I know we said we're talking about Daredevil, now we end up talking about the other pointy-eared character, but the reason you have to bring up one when you're mentioning the other, because what a lot of people don't realize is that Frank Miller is often referred to for his Batman works, rightfully so, but I feel what he contributed to the mythology of Daredevil is much more significant to me.
Why do you say that?
Because he in the case of Batman, he wrote the first possible Batman story and the last one. Whereas with Daredevil, he really built a body of work. He wrote the character for about 4 years in continuity, really brought in changes to Matt Murdock, to his relationships, enhanced his role in the Marvel Universe, and then he added so many spokes to the wheel of what Daredevil still is today, what people see on the Netflix show. If you like that show, you like Frank Miller. You would love Frank Miller's Daredevil comics. That's all there is to it. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't... there's no way you can argue it. In some ways, they've enhanced it, but in other ways, like, all those things that you're seeing in those shows, those come from Frank Miller.
Mm-hmm.
And then he... In this case, Daredevil Man Without Fear is basically his Daredevil Year One.
Yeah.
So, let's get into it. Daft J, take it away.
So, there's a total of 5 issues in this thing, right?
Yes, it came out 1993.
Oh, yeah.
This is a pretty aged book at this point, and it was his last work on Daredevil.
Really?
Yeah. So, the last thing he did was tell the origin story.
The origin story. Yes. Oh, how cool is that?
Yes. And he had this idea to work on this book... shortly after, I think, he did the story Born Again, which was very critically acclaimed. Some people consider it the greatest Daredevil story of all time. And I'm sure they're going to adapt that into the next season or two of the television show. But he had come to John Romita Jr. with this idea to do the Daredevil Man Without Fear. It was going to be a graphic novel. And then as he was coming up with the story, he kept adding more and more pages to it because he had all these things he wanted to flesh out and introduce and tell an origin for. But then he kind of disappeared off the face of the earth and went to work on movies. He wrote scripts for RoboCop and a couple of other things back in the late 80s. And John Romita's like, I don't know what happened. We had this idea. I was ready to go. We had the okay from Marvel to do it. And then it took a couple years and then he came back to the table and they finished the project, and I think it came out officially in 1993 as the cover dates on the 5 issues.
Hmm.
Okay. So let's get into a little bit of the first issue.
I think out of all of the issues, this was my favorite.
Okay, how come?
Well, it concentrated on the story between father and son and the relationship that Matt had with his dad, Jack Murdoch.
Yeah.
You obviously learn that his dad was a, I guess a struggling boxer fighter.
Mm-hmm.
But he, and the love that he had for Matt, he would do anything for him. And he only ever wanted the best for him.
It was a heartbreaking relationship that they had to see how close they were.
Mm-hmm.
And how much admiration he had for his father and how much self-loathing Jack had for himself, realizing that he wasn't the man he wanted to be for his son, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he kept having this strong desire for his son to be a better man. Like, it really played the heartstrings when you saw the way they viewed each other. One guy thought he was a loser. The other guy, the kid, thought his dad was a hero. It was, I don't know.
Well, yeah, like, he pretty much pleaded with Matt and, like, any son's dream is to be their dad.
Yeah.
At least at a young age. Yeah. You learn a little later on that you're like, yeah, not so much. But initially, your dad is your hero.
Absolutely.
That's how it is. And for Matt, that's what he thought of his dad. And it's kind of crazy how his father wanted him not to think of him that way.
Yeah.
He basically told him, I don't want you to be like me. I want you to use your head. I want you to study. I want you to be better than me. I want you to go far in life.
Yeah.
And there was a scenario in the story where Matt was being bullied at school and he wasn't doing anything about it. But then one day he just had it,
mm-hmm.
and he came home all excited. And of course, what father wouldn't be like, yeah, that's my boy. I'm a fighter. Of course, my kid's going to do the same thing. And so Matt's running up and being like, dad, I finally did it. I took him out. I knocked him out. His dad wasn't having it, and he bought right across the face, and he's like, this is not good. This is not how I raised you. You need to be better than this. Don't fight with your fists. Fight with your head.
Right.
And Matt was kind of like taken aback, like, oh man, like I thought he would be proud of me.
He was serious about that whole thing. Like, and don't be like me.
And then since then, he was still getting bullied at school. And he would be taunted. They'd be calling him Daredevil every day and making fun of him. And then Matt, out of respect and love for his father, would not fight back.
Yeah.
And it's not like he ran home and been like, oh, you know, they bullied me again. He would internalize that pain and not vocalize it to anyone that he was going through this torture at school.
Yeah. Speaking on what you're talking about, the whole Daredevil and the bullying factor, what I liked about those scenes was that Matt wasn't a punk kid who was a wimp. He could take care of himself. He had this fearless aspect to him early on. Like, that was just his character, to be fearless, to kind of be a daredevil, if mm-hmm. you will, right?
Well, he had a good rep in the neighborhood. I mean, there was that encounter with the police officer and, like, the neighborhood kids where they were playing with the fire extinguisher.
Fire hydrant.
And he's like, you know, this is against the law. What's wrong with you guys? You guys are hoodlums and this and that. You guys should be more like that Matt Murdoch kid. He's good. He doesn't bring any trouble. And then there's this masked child who manhandles this cop, takes his baton, and takes off, right? And we end up learning that it's Matt himself. So he was a good kid, but he had that thing of being mischievous.
Yes.
But he would never get caught.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And I like that in this story, you see the seeds planted that it was always in him to be a little bit of a rebel. Not so much a troublemaker, like he was causing mischief, but he could stand up for himself. He admired his father's abilities to fight, so he learned how to fight mm-hmm. to hold his own.
Well, he would go to the same gym that his dad would train at.
Yeah.
So, and when he was, you know, like I said, internalizing that pain that he was going through at school, he was going all out on a punching bag all by himself,
mm-hmm.
sobbing.
Yeah.
Out of what he, because of what he was going through, but that was his way of expressing his anger and frustration, was to be physical.
Yeah.
About it.
Yeah.
But technical, not just like crazy, I hate the world.
No, you know, he wanted to really...
It was very structured.
Yeah, he was always had a discipline about him. I like that they plant those seeds early. It wasn't just like, oh, he had an accident and all of a sudden now he's an acrobat.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I like that they showed him having this personality in him, these abilities in him.
Well, and then that ability became noticed by Stick.
After the accident.
After the accident.
Yeah.
He became blind after saving, you know, how ironic, a blind man from an oncoming truck that was about to take him out. And then Matt succumbs to this thing.
The radioactive sludge. Everything back in the 60s, then Stan Lee was creating these characters, was all radioactive.
Right.
Because the world was focused on atomic power and radioactivity. So Spider-Man was a radioactive spider. Matt Murdock was radioactive chemicals. The Hulk was gamma radiation.
Mm.
So it was a theme that he had going on back then.
Was it a theme or was it just... And forgive me, Stan Lee. But was it a theme or was it just a lack of imagination? I wonder that sometimes because there's such a consistency in certain things. You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like it's almost the same story being told.
Yeah. I think it was a little bit of, he was a really good idea man. And so the idea of the Hulk and Spider-Man and the X-Men, he had good ideas, but he didn't have the time, I think, to come up with separated explanations of, well, this guy gets his power from the sun, and this character is a princess of the Amazons, the way DC kind of had established it.
Mm.
So his way was, I'm creating so much stuff, how could I quickly explain how these people are getting powers?
But what's important, quantity or quality?
Well, quality, because clearly the things that Stan Lee created back then, at the pace he was creating them, standing the test of time. And what was key to those characters was not so much how did they get their powers, is who the person was. So when you see that Peter Parker is a very nuanced character, and the way that he responded to situations, it had never been done before. These were guys who had real problems. Matt Murdock was the first superhero with a disability. That was the key.
No way. That I didn't know.
That was the key, right? It's like, how can I make... Imagine a superhero who is blind.
Mm-hmm.
How does that work? So how does he get blind? Well, radioactive stuff gets in his eyes.
Yeah.
Get that out of the way. Everything's radioactive. And then from there, all his other senses are heightened. And I really liked, in this book, Frank Miller puts in place a lot of, in his exposition, because it's a narrator doing the exposition for the whole book. It's not your typical modern day comic where the character's talking and there isn't all thought bubbles. It was somebody following and telling you what Matt is going through and what he's feeling and describing these scenes. And I really like the portion when he is being trained by Stick, how it's described that people who have their eyes are missing out on all the details because they're not paying attention.
Yeah.
They're not using their ears. They're not using their sense of smell. They're not feeling the air around them. And everyone's like, well, Daredevil's such a dumb character. He's blind. How can he do all that? Well, yeah, you can argue that. But with his heightened senses, he's not blind in the sense of he can't see where a figure is. He knows what his surroundings are, but he can't see the details in a person's face.
I think it's depicted really well in the Netflix series because they obviously not only mention it, but they have you experience what Matt himself has experienced. So he's like, well, listen for their heartbeat.
Yeah.
Listen for the way they're breathing. Where is it coming from?
Right.
The body heat or whatnot. Listen for like what kind of weapons they have on them. It is really pretty cool how those types of And it's actually kind of scientific.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
When you are lacking one thing, there is a part of your brain that is enhanced a little bit more.
Absolutely.
To almost overcompensate what's missing.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, it is, that's actually pretty cool.
And people forget, he does have a power. He is like Batman in the sense that he's just a man and he's trained himself, but he does have a power.
Mm-hmm.
His heightened senses are a huge thing on his side. Because he is even stronger. It's often mentioned in the book, like, man, this guy is extremely strong. He can hold his own. But because of all of those, the hearing 5 blocks away, like, that's superpower.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The scent, the heightened scent, all of those things. So he is a superpowered character in his own right.
At first, though, when this happened to him, it was very, like, it kind of reminded me of Clark when he first starts getting his powers, where he's hearing and seeing certain things and it's freaking him out and he doesn't know what to do with it, and he thinks that his body is just changing, or he's not used to what's happening around him. So when he's in the hospital and he's, like, you know, hooked up to all this stuff, he's going nuts because mm-hmm. he can literally hear and feel and smell things that you really wouldn't.
Driving him crazy, yeah.
Yeah, he's losing his mind. Which then I was a little confused because he was visited by a nun.
Mm-hmm.
And she kind of soothes him, calls his crazy senses a blessing, and she tells him to keep this secret from even his father.
Yeah.
I don't know, because the nun starts kind of crying and tearing up, and then she leaves.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess basically says that she will kind of watch over him.
Yeah.
I think that's the presumption you get.
Yeah.
Is this supposed to be his mother?
Yes. Yes. It's his mother.
Really?
And yes. And the thing that's really cool about this book in particular is that Frank Miller is revisiting things that he did throughout his Daredevil run. And characters he introduced, and now he is doing a big payoff for them. So in the Born Again series, this nun nurses Matt back to health when he finds himself in a bad way, and you come to realize that this is his first time meeting his mother.
So did his dad know he got hooked nasty with a nun? Like, does he know this?
I think perhaps she became a nun after the fact when she...
And just fell off the earth?
And just disappeared. But she's always
because apparently... Because Matt's dad refers to the mom early when he's like, don't be like me, we owe it to your mom. Like, yes. What is that? I'm thinking, and at first I'm thinking, oh, the mom's dead, or maybe there was an accident, or maybe, like, she got sick and died. And then this lady is like, I'm here for you.
Yeah.
It's a blessing.
You're led to believe that she left because of perhaps... how unfit maybe for a time Jack Murdock was as a husband, as a father. And that perhaps is what made him come to his senses to become a better dad, because he realizes what a good woman he had and now she was no longer there. That maybe he scared her away.
Huh.
So.
But you say that there's other stories
yep,
that actually touch on this a little bit.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the whole him holding the cross, all of these little moments of it lends to what later becomes his faith in Catholicism, right? Matt Murdock is one of the few characters in all
who
of comics
religious...
who has some sort of religious devotion.
Okay.
So this visit, when he's in, you know, when he loses his sight, all contribute. And that's the cool thing about this book. It's like, he's explaining that now. He's getting a chance to tell that story. One thing we didn't mention was the fact that Jack Murdock also works for the mob, forcefully.
Yeah, he hates it.
He's an enforcer, and it's a part of his life that he absolutely despises and hates himself for.
He's ashamed of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why he keeps trying to teach Matt to be something more, because in his case, all he was ever good for was his muscle. No one respected him as a man. No one thought much of him as a person. He was just muscle to be used. So when he sees Matt still become disabled now, even more so, he wants his son to use his mind to be something better than he was. And it's in the television show, you see the touching relationship that they have and how much they care for each other and how capable Matt still is as a blind kid. And in this book, you see it as well, how when Matt watches his father box for the final time, his father chooses to win the match, going against the orders of the mob to lose for betting purposes, because he still feels that his son is watching him. He's still got to be a hero for his son.
I think it also, Jack thinks about Matt and desires to teach him the value of self-worth.
Yes.
And I think that's why because he was told to fix the fight and to purposely lose.
Yes.
But, you know, although Matt couldn't physically see what was going on, he knew that it would have as a father, he just thought it would have a detrimental effect on him if he didn't do the best that he could do.
It's almost like he sacrificed his life
mm-hmm.
to teach Matt that lesson.
Yeah, and he knew that it was coming.
Yeah,
he knew.
That was painful.
What a crazy thing, eh? To be like, this, basically it's like the last conversation that he could have with his son without having it.
Yeah.
Knowing that he was gonna not make it. Because when he was jumped and attacked, he basically said, all right, just get it over and done with. And it wasn't just a quick killing.
No.
They brutally beat him.
Softened him up.
And for Matt to then have to, like in the next issue, it continues with him basically having to go to the morgue. And it's just a very grueling, heavy story. Like, I thought it was great, but like I said, with Frank Miller's writing style, it really is some heavy content that was.
Yeah, it's definitely, it brings out all of the emotion that you're intended to feel.
Mm-hmm.
The sense of fear, the sense of pain, but also the desire for vengeance.
That's the thing too, you know, Matt kind of acted like he didn't know what happened or why his dad was killed. He pretended to know nothing.
Yeah.
And then decided to take matter into his own hands, which at this point, he was, like we mentioned before, was getting trained by Stick. So he was already kind of getting a feel of what he was capable of doing. Him and Matt and Stick would go out before dawn and like go across rooftops and do some stuff. And that's actually one of my favorite pictures.
What a great picture. I was just going to say, that shot, we're showing it now. We don't have video, obviously. But if you look up on Google, if you want to know the picture we're talking about, you just type in Matt Murdock and Stick, John Romita Jr. And John Romita Jr.'s art in this book, him and Frank Miller together as a team, creative team, his stuff is just beautiful. I love it. The training sequences with Stick,
it was grueling.
Oh, but just the scenes, the way he paces everything, you really feel the motion of it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're missing that today in comic books. But John Romita, I feel, is very good at keeping the story moving and getting a sense of motion from the characters. And
I find that it's a very patient art that he does. You know what I mean?
And you know what? This style, it's funny you say it's a very patient art, but his style, when he changed over to this look of it,
mm-hmm.
because he used to copy more of his father's style, John Romita Jr. And his father also worked on Daredevil. So this was Daredevil and Spider-Man were John Romita Sr.'s books that he was famous for. So now for his son to get a chance to work on them was like following in his father's footsteps, almost like Matt Murdock, you know, admiring his father's work. But he worked really fast. John Romita Jr. became a really quick worker and was able to find a way to tell good stories and deliver good art, but not be
on a timeline.
He never missed a deadline. That's what he was known for. And he's very proud of the fact that he never misses his deadlines. And in this book, I think this is the peak of his powers. I really love his artwork in this book. You want to move on to issue 2?
Let's do it.
Talk a little bit about it.
Mm-hmm.
Take it away.
So, issue 2, like I said, picks up with Matt finding out who's responsible for his dad's murder, and he kind of goes off on his own and goes after everyone who was involved. Like, even the limo driver. Like, he ain't playing. He actually ends up finding the mob boss that ordered the hit. However, he never really gets... He doesn't exactly kill these people. He didn't kill anyone. The mob boss died of a heart attack.
Yeah.
So I think, although he swore vengeance, I guess, because he kind of...
He's responsible for their deaths, but he doesn't
technically kill them. No, the two guys don't die in the beginning.
No.
Because remember, the cop finds them, and they're like, oh my goodness, Jack Murdoch is back from the dead. We shot him in the face.
Yes, yes.
And he's still alive. He's back to get us. Like, they didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
The mob boss died of a heart attack. And then the limo driver... He goes somewhere. And what ends up happening is that a civilian, an innocent civilian, dies in his pursuit of this one person. And that haunts Matt.
Right.
And I think that's when he, although I don't think he went out of his way to want to kill these people, he definitely wanted to teach him a lesson.
Yes.
I don't think his intention was to kill anyone, but when someone accidentally did, I think that's when he kind of knew he drew the line and never wanted to experience that, because it kind of put him in a state of shock.
I think in the case where he accidentally did, he was pretty careless, and he thrashes out and he causes the murder of that civilian, if you will. And this is one of the criticisms that you brought up before about Frank Miller and his things that he likes to do in his books that he gets criticized for that are sometimes very purposeful. He has this habit of always including prostitutes and having them killed in his stories.
Yeah.
There's that in...
yeah, I didn't want him, like, the limo driver went somewhere. I didn't want to specify.
No.
Because, yeah, it gets kind of like,
book is very intense and adult in nature without ever referencing or doing anything to make it rated R. It's done. Thank you for the noise. Her drink is done, if you're wondering.
And we're only on issue 2.
No. But he, in Dark Knight Returns, Selina Kyle works for for a call...
Pimp.
For an escort service, as well as in Year One.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Same thing. And now in this book, a prostitute is killed. And in Sin City, it's filled with prostitutes. So he has a habit, and people have criticized him for that his view on women is very misogynistic, oftentimes, the way he writes them. And so in the case of this story... That is one of the victims that Matt feels guilty for throughout the rest of the story. It keeps coming back to haunt him, the fact that this person died because of his desire to get vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
This is the issue also where we're introduced to Foggy. What do you think of Foggy in this story? Anything? Just that he snores a lot.
He's very well... I can see why they casted... The Mighty Ducks Bash brother in the Marvel's Daredevil show. He's perfect.
Yeah.
He's perfect.
Plays him all right.
He's smart and good-hearted, well-intentioned guy, but like a slob and just kind of goes with the flow.
Kind of frumpy.
Whatevs.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so at this point, he becomes best friends with this guy and roommates at Columbia University. So now we're being introduced to his hard payoff of having stuck to the books and studied so well. Well, now he's in law school.
Mm-hmm.
I
like how he takes care of Foggy. He's got a soft spot for him early on, right? He makes sure that he defends him when he sees that he's being mistreated by other classmates. To the point where now Foggy becomes a respectable student. Everybody's like, whoa, look at how this guy's getting treated now. What was the change of heart in these people? So I like that Matt was always looking out for, early in his life, the people that he cared about.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is the first time you see him in the black tracksuit, which was the... costume of season 1 of Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find a lot of the things that you saw from season 1?
Yes.
Were heavily pulled? Yeah.
From this? Oh yeah, for sure. I feel like everything came from this book.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Except Yeah.
Except for?
Elektra.
Yes. You're right. She but within the season two, you see a lot of the
fact that they met in school and they dated in school.
That early part in the flashbacks in it.
Yeah.
What did you think of Elektra being introduced to her for the first time?
No, I didn't like it.
Tell me.
I did not. Her, I love, I like the art of Mr. Junior. When he drew Elektra, drove me nuts. It just looked messy. It just looked.
That big hair.
Yeah, it was just, her lips were very liney, very, not cool. I didn't like her. You know what? She kind of reminded me of Poison Ivy a little bit.
With the hair?
Very, very, what's this mean? What does this mean?
the gangly? Like no, the
very, excessive.
Okay,
just overly
that was done. A good gesture. I should have got that. Your hands are in the air. It's like, she's looking, you're saying, hallelujah. But excessive is good.
Yeah, it was just a little too much for me. But I guess, however, it was a portrayal of her person. She kind of had a death wish. She was just very living life on the edge and didn't answer to nobody and kind of, you know, went to the beat of her own drum. So I guess her physical thing that he did here, she was not what I thought what would be in the Elektra, like that sultry, smart, dependent type of woman, like kind of like not demanding. But anyway, it wasn't.
She had she has her independent spirit. She doesn't need anybody. She'll get it done herself.
Right.
But yeah. I find, and this was purpose, because I read in some of the back matter of this book, Frank Miller specifically said to John Romita Jr., he's like, just a note, a side note, when you draw and portray Elektra, when you render her, show her that she's unstable. Draw her face that one minute she's smiling and the next minute she's intense. She's psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to
she was
bring that out in the art.
Yeah.
So show the inconsistency in her. Like, she's never unhappy to bring pain to a person, but she's also very, at the same time, going to suddenly be passionate. And
Mentally, she was on the brink.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So you were able to see that through the
visual. As much as I disliked it, I felt that, you know what, they're going with something here. I feel like they're just drawing her as a toxic character.
Yeah.
And they portrayed that very, very well.
Yeah.
I wasn't a fan of it, but yeah, point taken.
The scene within the Elektra issue that I really liked was when Matt breaks into the house because he's followed her after she's led him on a chase. He follows her back to her home, realizes that she is obviously comes from a very wealthy background. But the scene where he's fighting the guy with the machine gun, he kicks him out of the window, and the movement of the scene continues into the next big page where you see him coming through the ceiling, the glass ceiling of this huge room where they're having this gala.
Gala, yeah.
And Elektra's on display playing the piano as a piano savant, if you will. And just to see that movement come through and crash down, I like those panels from Romita. I think that, did you notice that? That smoothness of how he's here, you see these windows and then right through them.
Mm-hmm.
And her facial expressions, it doesn't even disturb her that someone's crashed through and landed on her piano.
Right on her piano while she's... And then she continues to play.
She continues to play with all the ruckus. She is unstable. The one part of this book that kind of irritated me was the scene where she goes looking for Matt, finds him in his dorm. They tear the room apart with some passion. But then she goes into Times Square, goes into an alleyway and draws in some seedy individuals, let's put it that way,
mm-hmm.
who want to take advantage of her.
But then she proceeds to take off her mink parka and kicks the crap out of them to the point of death. And she's wearing her underwears. And I'm like, you know what? That's just one of those things where...
And no shoes.
And no shoes.
In like, the dead of winter. I questioned that a little bit myself. Yeah,
that was one of the parts of the book that irritated me because I just did... Like, I knew that she was this thrill seeker, but to see her have to be presented that way, I was kind of like, really? Is this a product of 90s comics that they do this? Because I don't even like nowadays when they have certain characters where their costumes leave not much to the imagination. And in this case, it's dead of winter. She's wearing a parka. And all of a sudden, she's barefoot, ready to go to the beach and kicking the crap out of these guys. That was the one part that was kind of irritating. But it did lend to the fact that she is a nutcase.
Yeah.
So, moving on.
I'll tell you who thought she was a nutcase.
Who's that?
Stick.
Yeah. Stick, that's a good point.
Stick did not approve of this coming together.
Yes, you're right.
I think at this point, before we get on to the next issue, this is where I guess Matt kind of becomes infatuated with her.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of twisted how they kind of got together. It was a little bit... It's almost like she... So the first encounter was in the park where she basically got him in trouble with the law.
Yeah.
Then he goes seeking her out, finds her, has this moment with her, and then obviously she has this hurrah with these people in the alley, and Stick is like, you gotta stay away from her.
Yeah, she's
bad news. And Matt just could not stay away. He couldn't think of her being as a threat or not being what he thought she really was.
Right.
And was completely, like, blinded by her. How fitting is that? He's blind.
Exactly.
And...
It's metaphorical, really, when you think about it, right?
Yeah.
Like, he's just completely spellbound from her. And they are both somewhat blinded by their passions. And can't really make sense of it. They feel like they're right for each other, but they're completely wrong at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good way to describe it. He's blinded by this passion for her. The issue ends pretty powerfully. Your first introduction to Wilson Fisk, the kingpin, who snaps the neck of a mob leader and takes over...
Rigoletto.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah, Rigoletto. You're
welcome. Mm-hmm.
Who basically betrayed this guy because he considered the kingpin, who was... he had no name at this point.
Yeah, you don't know anything about him.
He thought he was a confidant, his only trusted friend, and in that moment, he just snaps his neck like nothing.
Yeah.
And basically takes over the business.
When I see him here portrayed, and then I think of the portrayal from the television show, I'm like, man, it just... So many layers to the character that... they bring out in the show. D'Onofrio does such an amazing job at adding elements to the kingpin that you don't really get from the book. You just kind of see him as this cold-blooded mob boss. But they did a good job at casting, for sure. So in issue 4, Matt Murdock now works at a firm in Boston, but his firm sends him back to New York City for a case to handle some business, if you will. And as he's there revisiting some of his old stomping grounds, this scene here that he confronts these thugs that attack him and want to steal his $300 suit. That was funny. That's a nice $300 suit. Nowadays, a $300 suit, where do you get that from? Tip Top? But back then, that was big money. This kind of reminded me a little bit. I don't know if you remember in The Dark Knight where Bruce encounters those mutants. And they're all, like, ready to to mug him. Mm-hmm. And he's like...
Bring it.
And he's like, well, this guy...
They're like,
this guy's into it. It ain't cool when they're into it.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of reminded me of that scene where you see a sharply dressed man happily engage in a brawl with some street thugs. As Matt goes back into his Hell's Kitchen territory, pays a visit. He's actually working on a case with Foggy. They reconnect, which is cool. But he pays a visit back to the gym. And in the gym, he encounters what ends up being somewhat of a key character.
Yeah, he meets this girl named Mickey. mm-hmm. who introduces herself as Mickey and as an orphan. Build this friendship together. They meet up. They work out together at the abandoned gym where his dad would work out. At this point in the story, I kind of started picking up cues in Frank Miller's writing style.
Mm-hmm.
I found that the way he would write the story, it would allow the reader to piece certain things together.
Okay, what do you mean?
Okay, so, for example, Mickey, like I said, tells Matt, I'm an orphan. I got nobody. I'm by myself. I got nothing to do. But within a couple of pages as you read on, you find out that Mickey actually has another name. You find out that she actually comes from a loving family. The picture that she originally portrayed was not mm-hmm. was not that. And I find that Frank Miller kind of does that throughout the story. He tells a story, and then in the next issue, he gives you clues to kind of stitch the previous issues together.
Right.
Another thing that I picked up was I kind of wondered why they would bully Matt and call him Daredevil in the courtyard when he would be at school. And I'm like, that's just random. And no one's talking about why this is happening.
Right.
But then, you know, what is this, issue 3?
Issue 4, almost okay. issue 5.
Okay, so issue 4, now it turns out that Jack Murdock, because we knew that he would do anything to provide for his family, at one point in his wrestling career or boxing, he donned this luchador look dressed up as a Red Devil. And it was one of the most horrendous, it was one of those that kind of mocked his profession.
Yeah.
And he was ashamed of it. Matt was embarrassed about it. And because of that, they would bully Matt and say, oh, Daredevil, Daredevil. Because they were actually making fun of his dad.
Right.
And making fun of him by association. So the bullies got the name from the poster
mm-hmm.
of when his dad would fight under that character. And so now it comes back like, oh, that's where they got the name from. Oh, that's why it burns him when they would call him Daredevil.
Yeah.
That's why it's torture to him. That's why he didn't like it. That's why he retaliated when people would call him this name. But then later on, as the story continues, he embraces that name. The yeah. one that people would beat him down with, that's the one he rose with. So that's what I'm saying, like piecing certain events
at you first. Earn it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I like that. It felt like a reward.
Yeah,
for like, paying attention to these details and not being impatient because you didn't get it the first time.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely. I mean, I was going to make another crack at a really bad movie that was recently released, but I'm not going to do it. It's just really nice when you see threads be planted or seeds be planted, and there's, like you said, a thread throughout the book, and there's a constant reference of being called the Daredevil, and it was something that irritated him. But in the end, when he is out to rectify a horrendous situation, he embraces the fear
mm-hmm.
that people get from seeing him and realizing that, you know what? I am the Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
I am the one who is going to take the chance. I am the son of Jack the Devil Murdock.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to embrace this thing. I'm no longer going to be ashamed of it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it means more.
And even if it wasn't a public whatever, at least it was something that he was able to embrace himself.
Right.
And be content with.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's kind of what gave him his drive.
And he was proud of it in the end.
Yeah.
Yeah. In issue 4, you see, when you find out that Mickey, she doesn't come from a well-to-do family. It's just a regular family, two parents at home. But she gets kidnapped from an offshoot group of drug dealers.
Junkies. Or
junkies
yeah.
who are associated with little rings or these other little, what's the word I'm looking for here? I'm at a loss right now. These small little outfits all connected eventually to the kingpin, but they are involved in not only drug trafficking, but also in kidnapping children for...
Prostitution. I couldn't believe it. I was like, okay, this is getting a little... Okay, you want to throw in a whore here and there? Or I shouldn't have said that word. But, like, to give the perception of the environment that you're in, fine. But, I found that some of this content was so heavy. And, obviously, there was no...
Nothing is shown. Not even said. That was the thing, is that it's never referred to... You're never told what they're going to do with them, but enough is put in place that it's easy to come to that conclusion. It's exactly. Like all insinuated.
And then I felt bad for, like, is this... Am I twisted for thinking that this is what it could be?
Right.
Or is this what it actually is?
No.
Maybe it's something else. So I'm going to pretend it's something else. Like, I found in my head, I was just like, oh my gosh, like, what is happening here? Like,
it's again, like I said before, one of those things that Frank Miller is known for doing. And a lot of comic book, this is one of those things that become a trope, right? Make the female be sexually abused. And that's her story. Mm-hmm. That always kind of becomes the trope all the time. And in this case, it was victimized children. But it works because it makes Matt embrace his desire for vengeance and to right this wrong. Because now his friend has been kidnapped, but it leads him to see that there's a whole operation of people being kidnapped and victimized. Mm-hmm. And it puts a new drive in him, helps him to realize what now he's really doing in New York, why he's been called back, why the devil, in a way, has been called back to Hell's Kitchen to rectify these wrongs that are taking place. And so there, in issue 5, now it's a good segue, I think, to get into it, but you see Matt completely don the Daredevil Season 1 outfit with the bandana tied around his head. Actually, what I think Frank Miller drew this from was the Princess Bride. He looks a lot like Wesley... the Dread Pirate Roberts. This is the outfit from Princess Bride, if anyone hasn't seen Daredevil Season 1. That's what he looks like.
You're funny.
And it works. It works. And he kicks some serious butt. And it's really, really great action scenes that John Romita Jr. is putting us through. It plays out like an awesome film.
Can I see page 133?
133.
Yeah, because I wrote...
This is a cool panel. This is a cool page right here where you got to flip the book on its side.
Yeah.
And see what's going on with Matt and the gangsters.
It was very cool.
130, this one.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's my favorite picture in the whole thing.
Yeah. That's extremely iconic.
Yeah. That's, again, when he's donning the whole...
Dread Pirate Roberts. Princess Bride.
But it was just the whole page took up the...
He was coming.
The larger than life. Yeah. Like, that's him coming into his own. I thought it was a great embodiment of what they were trying to say.
Yeah. Do you want to talk in detail about the action scene or not spoil it and let the person who wants to read it?
I thought it was great. And I honestly, if we want to shorten this piece, watch season 1. Basically.
Or read this book.
Yeah, no, for sure.
I would
sure.
highly recommend people for to sure. read this book.
I would, but I did. But yes. If you wanted to, like, see live action of what we're talking about, season 1 is a great depiction of this story, particularly this issue of the book.
Yeah, they really capture this whole... Everything you see in this particular issue, they captured and then some. They go into much more detail in the show, I think.
The one thing I had an issue with is when Mickey is captured, obviously when you're yeah. victimized or yep. when you're going to be a victim.
Like I think I know what you're going to say.
You're kind of frazzled panicking. And you start saying things.
Yeah.
And she really, because she, having spent time with him and working out with him at the gym and doing all of this, she obviously came to know of his abilities. She knew that he had this incredible sense of... what he was doing. He could do things that no other blind man could. In this sense, however, she kind of blurted it out.
Well, not screamed it at the top of her lungs a million times, screaming his name. Yeah. And I'm like, wait a second, you're giving it away. How can anyone not know who he ends up being?
Yeah.
One of the... Okay, let me ask your opinion on this. Now, I really enjoyed the story because I liked Daredevil and Frank Miller's Daredevil, but I thought perhaps this whole situation with Mickey and her being abducted and her parents, you know, having to... It was a cool...
pay a ransom?
Yeah, like the way that everyone kind of got involved was interesting. But what I wondered was this a little bit of a cheat to get Matt to the next stage? Because how it's never really said how long he's been in New York for, because he's only supposed to be there for a short period of time. How much time did he spend with Mickey working out at the gym? Is it just a day where it shows him kind of working out at the gym with her, skipping rope, and they just chit-chat? Like, do you know what I mean? For him to care so much to now...
I think it was insinuated that he was there for a short period of time, because then the reason why he knew of Mickey's missing was because he did get called back to Boston, where his corporate law office was. Yeah. And he just wanted to stop by and say goodbye.
Right.
But in approaching where she lived... No, when he went to the gym, he found her hat, right, and was able to distinguish that something was wrong.
Right.
And again, followed the found her address and overheard that there was a situation going on. Anyway, I think it was, I'm going to say it was like a 3-day trip.
It's not.
It's a 3 to 5 day trip. Yeah. Something like that. Like, less that was than
my
a week.
That was my only, kind of, I don't know if it's a nitpick.
You want to know why I say that? Because when his boss called him back, he was kind of like, what's happening here? Get your butt back here.
Yeah, if you're not back here by tomorrow, you're like, done. You don't got a job.
So I think it was kind of like, not, he didn't overstay, but I think it was a quick trip.
Yeah, that was my only kind of nitpick.
And but really, if she gave this illusion that she didn't have anyone, then her only free time would be at the gym where he would be. So they would kind of like constantly be together. You know what I mean?
That's the thing. Like, I was a little bit, that was the part that kind of like, is this enough to make him do this now?
Yeah, but because I don't think.
Because he liked his life in Boston. He wasn't particularly happy to be back in New York because of all of the motions that.
Yeah, but I don't think you need to have. As much as I'm all about, you know, character development and all of this business, you don't have to know someone to their core to be able to do the right thing, to be a good civilian. If you know that someone needs help, heck, if you think that someone needs to sit down, you give up your seat. You do the right thing for some. Why are you laughing? Am I not saying?
No, you just said something to me that reminded me of people I see on the bus sometimes. I didn't want to even get into it about sharing seats, but that's another story for another time.
But do you know what I mean? I don't think we need to know each other so long for us to feel like we need to help each other or lend a hand when something is wrong.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think here's the thing, is that having read.
And you know what? I was a little bit surprised, because when I first met Mickey, I thought she was kind of like in his age bracket.
She's a little kid.
She's tiny.
Yeah.
Apparently, these monsters were specifically targeting
12-year-olds.
People as young as 12.
Yeah.
Terrible.
Horrible.
I think it turned out that she was about 14, 15.
Yeah. And that was wherein the problem laid, where there was a double coup where the people who had kidnapped her for the kingpin were also going to do a side ransom deal because they weren't going to get the money for her that was promised because she wasn't 12. It was it upsets you to the point where you're like, these guys need to be like shot in the head.
Yeah.
But what I was going to say was, throughout Daredevil, especially Frank Miller's iteration or run of Daredevil, he slowly becomes a person who doesn't keep his relationships intact, or he doesn't nurture them as much as he should, because he becomes so obsessed with his nightly activities of being a vigilante. And in this story, because I guess it's a Daredevil Begins, if you will, you see him be very passionate about the relationships he does have and very protective of the people who he does become friends with. You see it with his father. You see it with Foggy. And now with this young girl who he has a bit of a kinship with, revisiting New York, you see him now still have that drive to defend and to protect.
Well, I think him having prolonged his stay in New York, like you said, I think that kind of... It helped him find his true calling.
It was almost like the...
Because, think about it. He was doing corporate law.
Yes.
And it was very structured, tedious. Very business-like. On the other hand, Foggy was dealing with a lot of people law.
Right.
What's the word again? It's in the book, but... Civil... Not civil. Anyway, it was very, like, wrong versus right. Mm-hmm. Justice versus injustices. And right here.
Class actions.
Yeah, like Foggy would do a lot of class action suits and stuff. And it kind of drove Matt. At the end, he kind of took a little bit a lead on the case while Foggy would like fall asleep and kind of be... But he found that passion in wanting to fight for the weak person. The poor people.
Yeah.
And those that can't or don't have the power to fight for themselves. Mm-hmm. So, him coming to that realization, you know, not only in the law aspect, but also donning the daredevil gear that he stitched together himself.
That was a cool scene.
He embraced that part of himself, which I thought was pretty... It was pretty neat.
And there's that little scene there at the end where Stick has still been watching him all these years and keeping an eye on him. And for me, when I read this book a couple years ago, I hadn't really delved into any of the Marvel Universe in detail other than Spider-Man. And so I wanted to give Daredevil a chance. And so I bought a bunch of different Daredevil books. I didn't know where to start, so I figured I'd start with this one since it was kind of like an origin story. So it set up all of these pieces that are well-established characters, storylines, little histories that when I read this, I didn't understand the weight of any of it. I just read this story, and I'm like, oh, there's this guy. Oh, okay, there's that. Oh, I know Kingpin's going to be important, or I know Elektra's...
I've heard that name before.
Yeah, I know that they're important. I know they're relevant,
yeah.
But now having read this years later, a second time, after reading all of the Frank Miller Daredevil stuff that came before this, this book was so much better. I was like, oh, this is so good because now I understand the importance of Stick mm-hmm. and what comes later. There's all of these
because
elements.
Because of the comics, though, or because of the TV show?
Because of the comics. In the TV show, I freak out because I read the comics. I'm like, oh my goodness, I know where this is going. It's going to be like... There's so much mystery and intrigue.
And your characters are coming to life.
And they're done so well, right? When you see Stick on the show, after you've read this, you're like, they got it.
Right. Yeah, that's how I feel.
Yes.
Because I haven't dabbled into anything like this before. I think this is my... No, this is my second Daredevil, because I did Daredevil Yellow before. That's a great comic,
Which works well as a part two to this book. If you will, right?
Yeah, I think so. But because this was my only, or that was my only intro, having seen the TV show and then piecing it to, like, oh, that's why they chose that character to play that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's why he's, you know, Stick is, like, dead on. Like, that's perfect. Perfect representation of the character.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it was kind of the opposite.
Right.
Because I don't have a Marvel... history or knowledge the way you do.
Well, I'm not definitely not a comic book expert, just a fan. But now having read this yourself, does it motivate you to dig a little bit deeper into the Daredevil back issues, the mythology, the other books?
I really think so, especially because... Of course, we all know I love anything Batman. I think he's a great character. I think the stories used to tell his story are phenomenal. Mm-hmm. I feel like Daredevil is the Batman in the Marvel universe. He's, you know, does the thing at night and, you know, has fearless and motivated by finding justice and fighting for people that can't. You know, it has a drive and discipline and is, you know, doesn't matter what kind of physical limitations he has, he pushes through it.
Sometimes I feel when I read Daredevil and I know what your interests are in characters, I almost feel like you would like him even better.
No.
And I know that's a stretch. That's a
very, very bold statement.
It's a bold statement, but because of the things that he stands for and fights for and sometimes can't be bothered with, you know, sometimes he just doesn't have the patience for certain nonsense that's going on in life. Even sometimes relationships. He's like, I don't got time for that. There's people that need to be protected. There's someone out here doing this to children. There's someone out there doing that. And the way Batman is, right? Very similar to Batman. Mm-hmm. And when you go back and read Frank Miller's run on Daredevil, and then you realize this all came before anything he touched on Batman, you'll be like, he just did Daredevil on Batman. That's almost what it feels like after you read it. So it makes you kind of be like, do you know what I'm saying? I read it and I'm like, Lady J would love Daredevil. And so far, what you've read from the character, you've been a fan of, yes? Now you're backtracking. Like, no one's better than Batman.
You're scaring me a little bit. But, no, yeah, I would say so. After that description, yeah. I think he's my Batman in Marvel. Yeah. I'd keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd keep going.
So your overall rating for this book, what would it be? What would you give it?
I feel... I'm going to say 8. Are we doing out of 10 or what are we doing? What do you mean
over? We're going to do it out of 45. Oh. Just kidding.
It's so confusing. No.
Do it out of 10, yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to say an 8. 7.5, 8.
Really? That low? 7.5?
I know I said 8 first a lot of times before I said 7.5.
So okay, let's break it up in this way. What would you give the art?
Okay, the art is very meh for me. I like it. Okay, Elektra was... I did not like it. But okay. Like I said, I think... You know what? I'm going to take that back too. Oh my goodness, just get the words out. I like the art a lot.
What would you give that out of the 10?
I don't know what I could do. The thing with the art is that I found that as much as there were times that I loved the art, and then there was just as many times as I disliked it. But I found that the art reflected the emotion that was being conveyed throughout the story.
And that's when you know the art works, right?
So that's why I can't give it a number, because I know it was excellent, but it wasn't always my preference. So I don't think it would be fair to give it a rating.
Well, you said excellent, so that's a good rating in and of itself.
Okay.
So whatever people consider excellent to be. okay, and the writing.
Writing was heavy and dark, and the word crack cocaine was in it, and and the presumption that there was some kind of, you know, child prostitution and junkies. Like, it's very heavy.
But none of that is shown.
It's not shown.
Thankfully,
but you know what? I kind of, as twisted as that sounds, I kind of appreciate it, because that is kind of the world we live in.
Yeah.
We don't live in a... Anyway, it's crappy.
Yeah, no.
These things really happen, and yeah. It's unfortunate, and it's terrible, and
it would be nice if there that the point of these stories is, let's pick the scab that hurts us all in life, but let's throw in a character who's going to right that wrong. That's what these stories are meant for us to feel. I wish there was a Daredevil who would, you know, tear apart a dock or a factory where this is happening and it gets rectified and all these people get caught.
Before anyone gets hurt.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I wish there was a Batman who in the middle of the night tracks down these perps and gives them what they deserve. And what they deserve isn't, you know, 5 to 10 years in jail. It's 5 to 10 years in jail, no teeth, and a broken nose for life. Type of situation. You know what I mean? Those are the type of things that we really wish these people would experience. And when we read these stories, it gives us that sense of fulfillment. Like, that's what should be done to these perpetrators of that, that harm, whether it's children, women, innocent,
yeah.
Right? The disenfranchised people. So, as disturbing as it is, the point is that there's someone like a daredevil at the end watching over and trying to protect.
Mm-hmm. Good story, good art. I like it all.
No rating.
No
rating. Can't rate it.
How about you?
Having read it for a second time and having more of the back information, I would give it an A.
Letter system?
I give it a letter
system. A grading system?
It gets an A.
Well, okay, I give it an A-.
You still have a hard time giving it a rating. I don't know if a number can quantify it, because I love John Romita's artwork in this. The story doesn't... It ages well. It still holds up. It's one of the finest Daredevil stories out there. Mm-hmm. If anybody wants to pick up a Daredevil story just to... They don't know where to start, this is a great place to start.
Yeah.
That's what I would say. If you want to pick up Daredevil and you've either watched a couple of episodes of the show and you want to get into it, or just read a good novel, that's how this was designed to be. This was written as a story. It was meant to be a graphic novel. So if you want something like that with Daredevil in it to kind of show his beta years, if you will.
So graphic novel. So the issues that we just discussed, they purposely separate it? Like, what do you mean? So it is a graphic novel. It wasn't released individually?
It was released in 5 individual issues. The format changed, but initially it was meant to come out as one, 90-page story. And Frank Miller just wanted to add a couple more things to it. And they saw, hey, we can separate these into 5 issues and then collect them. It's all about business, right? Each of these issues was $4 each. Back in 1993, which was an expensive book.
Really?
Back then.
Yeah.
Right? So, comic books today cost $4 each. Mm-hmm. So back in 23 years ago, that was a pretty penny. And then they packaged it together a bunch of times and sold it as a graphic novel, but it was meant to be read like this.
Very cool. Yeah. I didn't know that.
So, rave reviews from Daft J.
Yes.
You're going to read more Daredevil.
I think I want to do it.
You're going to stick in the Marvel Universe for a little bit?
I am, once I'm done with Death
and
the Maidens.
All right, what's next for you on the docket?
A movie.
No more reading. It's too many people working in the brain, pulling all the levers. Like, she's reading too much. She's not sleeping on the train. Awesome. Thank you guys so much for listening. This was a deluxe episode. Our episodes are getting more in-depth. When you bring your notebook with you, I know we're in for a good conversation. So thank you, Daft J. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Visit us at caveofsolitude.com. Write us an email at caveofsolitude@outlook.com. And if you are looking for Daredevil, The Man Without Fear, go to Cyber City Comics on Steeles and Carpenter Road in North York, Ontario. North York, Toronto, whatever you want to, however you want to put it. Go see Daryl. Tell him the Cave of Solitude sent you. And they will have a copy of The Man Without Fear there. Thanks again, guys, for listening. I am Eric Anthony.
I'm Daphne J.
Take care, everybody.